From NPR News, you're listening to the best of Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz, the host of the program on Saturdays and Sundays. This episode, PJ Crowley called the Pentagon's treatment of the WikiLeaker Bradley Manning stupid, and he lost his job. But he's unshackled now, and he's speaking his mind. Also, remember when Retro TV used to be the Brady Bunch? Well, those classic TV channels are now playing episodes of Friends. Depressing, I know. And later, how Michael Peach, an editor at Little Brown, took thousands of pages of notes and manuscripts and scraps of paper that were left behind by the late David Foster Wallace and turned it into his unfinished novel, The Pale King. We'll also visit the largest urban farm in Los Angeles. It's in the city of Compton. It is really there. And the most exuberant, over-the-top, and yet still somehow charming opera star in the world, Vittorio Grigolo. That's on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered.
Now that the U.S. has intervened in Libya, does this set a precedent? And what does it mean for U.S. military involvement in other countries? We went to P.J. Crowley for some insight on this. He's former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State and spokesman for the State Department. He told us a lot of stars would have to align for the U.S. to intervene in the affairs of another country the way it did 3 weeks ago in Libya. Crowley spoke with Guy earlier this week.
Gaddafi has done something that nobody else has done. It's one thing to turn your police to control protests, to maintain public order. What Gaddafi was contemplating is using his military and his mercenaries to put down an opposition, to perhaps eliminate the opposition. That is of a different scale. But I also think it's important for the United States to send a message to these other countries, because this is a revolution and it's also an evolution. Tunisia was the first out of the barrel. Mubarak had the opportunity to see what happened. Gaddafi had the opportunity to see what happened in the other two countries. Everybody is watching what's happening in Libya. So the intervention, I think, does send a very strong message to leaders across the region. You've got to reform. You've got to do it peacefully.
Does it, in a sense, put pressure now, though, on the administration? I mean, say there is wide-scale violations of human rights in Syria. Let's just say that Bashar al-Assad decides to turn the military on his people, on protesters. Wouldn't that put an immense amount of pressure on the United States and on NATO to do something?
It would certainly have to be considered. But understand, there were a unique set of circumstances in Libya. And central was the encouragement by the Arab League and the Gulf states to intervene, backed by a very strong UN Security Council resolution and a willingness from NATO to take on this responsibility. So I think if you have those kinds of ingredients, if there's a future crisis in Syria or another country, then that becomes an active option.
P.J. Crowley, do you think that the outcome in the Middle East and North Africa will ultimately be good for the United States?
There's no question that this is going to be messy, ugly in the short term, but helping to transform a vital region to the United States, you know, to being more representative, more politically open, more market-driven in terms of economy, more stable from a social and ethnic and religious standpoint, is definitely in the interest of the United States.
Let me ask you about a different issue. You recently stepped down as a State Department spokesman last month. You were critical of the treatment of Bradley Manning. He is the Army private who allegedly leaked those documents to WikiLeaks. You called his treatment ridiculous, stupid, counterproductive, and so on. Do you still think so?
As a public diplomat standing at a podium, it was my responsibility to challenge other countries and the treatment of their citizens or the treatment of journalists or where we had concerns about violations of rights. But it is also my responsibility to interpret and recognize when things that we do cause concern or undermine our national interest. Having been directly involved in the WikiLeaks release, it has done damage to our national interest.
You believe Bradley Manning should spend time in prison?
Assuming that the government can make its case, and I believe it can, he should spend a long time in prison. But we also have a presumption of innocence until proven otherwise.
He's been stripped naked, we know, for example, been put in isolation. You say that's extreme.
I say that that may well be legal. I don't think it's smart policy because it has undermined the credibility of an otherwise legitimate prosecution. You know, as a global superpower, we have to lead by example. If we want to have influence in the world, we have to be above reproach. And I just thought that this approach to Bradley Manning's treatment while waiting, you know, the trial, is counterproductive.
That's P.J. Crowley, former Assistant Secretary of State and spokesman for the U.S. Department of State. He joined me here in our studios. P.J. Crowley, thanks.
Thanks very much, Guy.
So if you ever watch late-night television, you may have noticed something about the shows playing on those classic TV channels. On Nick at Night, for instance, you used to be able to catch old shows like The Brady Bunch. But starting this fall, Nickelodeon's late-night lineup will feature television so recent, most people over 25 haven't even heard of it. Producer Brent Bachman reports on nostalgia for a time barely gone by.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Dan.
I'm Brent.
Here's a trick. Next time you meet someone born after, say, 1985, just mention Nickelodeon and the 90s. Instant conversation starter. That's because, if you haven't done the math already, in the 90s, people now in their 20s were children, and arguably the last generation to use television as their main cultural snorkel to the universe.
I specifically remember sitting in front of the TV.
As close to the TV as I could.
Close enough that I could reach out and touch it.
This very scientific panel of young people, by the way, is made up of a few interns here at NPR, Dan, Becky, and Megan. And you're how old?
I am 22 years old.
23. I'm 21.
They're all children of the 1990s.
And kids' television up until that point was actually developed through an adult point of view looking into a kid's world.
That is Seema Zargami,
the president of Nickelodeon.
She's talking about shows like Clarissa Explains It All.
The first show where a girl really spoke directly to camera about all the issues and comedy that goes with being a tween.
Or Pete and Pete.
No, not a typo. A fabulously funny show, very quirky, about two brothers with the same name.
And people in their 20s have a deep relationship with this kind of television. It's from their childhood. That's not unusual.
In television, everything comes back approximately 20 years after it first existed, but I think this is the first time it's happened quite so young.
And there could be reasons for that nostalgia. Children of the 1990s came of age in a time of constant war, economic anxiety, and a pretty depressing job market.
Perhaps most importantly for this generation, it was a time before ubiquitous communication.
Eric Kleinenberg,
that's me,
is a sociologist at New York University. And he says it seems significant that young people are nostalgic for a time barely 10 years ago.
I've been wondering whether it's possible that this is a generation that goes in front of the television and watches old shows precisely to get away from the media torrent.
In other words, TV used to be part of the noise of modern life. But when you think about all the ways your attention is divided today...
I have my radio that wakes me up.
It's Morning Edition from NPR.
My smartphone.
That I check for email.
3 email addresses.
Blogs on my Google Reader.
A lot of news and politics.
Listen to a podcast on the way to work.
I don't have any sort of MP3 player.
What do you do on your way to work?
Check online and answer emails.
Probably Facebook.
Four other email addresses.
At the end of the day, compared to that, television almost feels like a relief.
But I do think when I turn off my phone and turn off my computer and sit in front of the TV, I am very calm.
It seems in a weird way that television is a way of shutting off the media.
One paradox in all this is that new media led to Nickelodeon's programming decision in the first place. The network noticed huge enthusiasm for these older programs online, and which specific shows are broadcast will be voted on through social networks.
We'll pick the, four or five that we start with, but from then on in, we'll do it based on demand, and we'll have some fun with that.
Nickelodeon is counting on the fact that people like 22-year-old Dan Marica will stay engaged with those shows, and he says he probably will, because most people his age will.
It's the fact that it's something we all relate to in a world that there's not many things that are so relatable.
It's a connection when there are fewer ways to connect.
Exactly. Right, it's a connection when there's fewer ways to connect. Exactly.
Isn't that kind of sad in a way, though?
I think so. I don't think it's a terrible thing.
Again, Eric Kleinenberg from New York University.
Perhaps the good news is that they're looking for a time when they could be by themselves and, to let their mind wander and to develop some sense of themselves.
Brent Bachman, NPR News.
Compton, California, called the eighth most dangerous city in America last year. More than 500 violent crimes so far this year. The place that put gangster rap on the map, that turned Dre, Ice Cube, and Eazy-E into household names. But in one part of the city, this is what the break of dawn sounds like. Welcome to the other Compton. It's called Richland Farms. And this morning, as he does every morning, Tomas Carlos walks into his barn in his backyard, and he picks up some freshly laid chicken eggs and starts to feed his horses.
I think I have close to 50 or so chickens.
And where do they lay their eggs?
Right? Sometimes they put them in here. You know, I have sections where... You kind of have to look around, and then you'll find eggs, and you'll know that that's...
Farm-fresh, free-range eggs from the city of Compton. In exchange for his eggs, Carlos often picks up some homemade cheese from neighbors who raise goats. Sometimes he grabs a cage-free chicken from a friend down the block. And all of that happens right here in a 10-block neighborhood of Compton, California. It is the largest urban agricultural zone in the entire Los Angeles basin, where in almost every backyard you'll find horses... and goats or cows, even chickens. The neighborhood's called Richland Farms. It's not one farm. It's several homes that make up the farm. And back in 1888, the man who owned the land, Griffith Compton, donated it to the county, but on one condition, that this part of Compton be zoned for agricultural use.
Richland Farms was started at a time in the county when it was very popular to have a home that had a very small acreage around it, like a half an acre to 3 acres, and there were places like this all over the county. What's unique is that this one still exists.
That's Rachel Searles. She studies the history of agricultural planning in L.A., and she says back in 1950, Los Angeles was the biggest agricultural county in the United States. Today, it's the most urbanized, and yet somehow, no developer, no city planner, no politician was able to touch Richland Farms. When Tupac and Dre rapped about Compton in this song in 1995, they described it as the Wild Wild West. And while the analogy is almost certainly about something else, here in Richland Farms, it's almost freakishly accurate. It takes a bit of getting used to seeing young men on horseback wearing cowboy hats trotting through the streets of Compton, but this is all very, very normal for Yvonne Arsenault. She's a Compton councilwoman, and she's lived in this neighborhood most of her life.
My husband actually had an aviary, and we started raising birds. We had all kinds of tropical birds. My children immediately became members of the 4-H Club, so we started with cows, we had donkeys, goats. I even had a horse.
When Arsenault was a young girl, most of the people in Compton were still white. Two future presidents even lived here for a while. The young family man George H.W. Bush raised his son George W. in Compton for a brief spell in the late 1940s. But around that time, neighborhoods here began to integrate, and middle-class African Americans like Yvonne Arsenault's family started to move in.
The complexion of the community has changed a lot. It was predominantly African-American. When I first moved here, we had some Caucasians still here, but within, I guess, maybe the last 10 years, it has changed. We still have a lot of longtime residents that still live here that are African-American, but we have a lot of Hispanics here now.
And change has created some tension between the old-timers and the newcomers. Many of the Latino families who are now here are originally from Mexico, the rural parts, where everyone raised animals on their land. When Tomas Carlos's father, Luis, arrived here almost 4 decades ago from Zacatecas in Mexico, he was worried that his kids would never grow up with a connection to the land. In Mexico, Luis was a charro, a rancher, and a horseman. So when he stumbled on Richland Farms, he just knew it would be the perfect place to raise his family.
My dad already had a saddle. We had no horses, but he already had a saddle. So he's kind of putting the cart before the horse. And
when we saw that, we knew it was just a matter of time before the horses came. And next thing you know, my dad wanted to build chicken coops. And so the first was the chickens, the saddle, the chickens, then the horses, then the goats. It was right away.
Today, Tomas Carlos calls their patch of land Hub City Farms. He and his dad compete in horse shows all over the country. They even have jackets that say Hub City Farms, Compton, California. And a few weeks ago, they went to a horse show in Idaho wearing their Compton jackets. And the inevitable questions were asked.
It's the first thing, well, do you know Eazy-E? Do you know Dr. Dre? What about the shootings?
We're born and raised in Compton.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, when Councilwoman Yvonne Arsenault was growing up, Richland Farms was predominantly African-American, solidly middle class. And most of those old-timers are now gone. She says back in the old days, animal rearing was more of a hobby, but now it's different.
I think that the raising of animals is on a much larger scale now, to the point that it is a problem sometimes.
Yvonne explains that some of the newcomers have started to lease out parcels of their backyards for non-residents to keep horses and goats. That's illegal. And last year, a few others were selling raw milk from their cows, also not allowed. And then there was the cockfighting. Now, in parts of Mexico, cockfighting is a tradition. In Compton, it's illegal. But some of the residents in Richland Farms were still staging fights. And so, on fight nights, dozens of people from outside the neighborhood would park on the streets until the early morning hours. So Yvonne Arsenault had the city council ban street parking for non-residents.
What has happened here today with the preferential parking is to preserve the lifestyle in the Richland Farms area.
But many of the Latino residents here see it as a reaction to their growing numbers. Again, here's Tomas Carlos.
Yes, you do have cleaner streets. You do have less traffic in your community. But you also have less family gatherings because now you have to go to the city and you get permits and you're only allowed certain permits, and the means doesn't justify the ends.
A few steps from Tomas's home, Maisha Akbar sits under a canopy as her brother drives by on his tractor.
His favorite thing to do, play on the toys.
Behind Maisha Akbar's home is a working dude ranch. She keeps several horses and runs a youth club called the Compton Junior Posse. Maisha is African-American. She's also unhappy about the parking restrictions, but she thinks the tension is more about a generational shift rather than a racial one.
People are afraid of change, and as the demographics change in the city of Compton, there are a lot of people who are afraid of that.
And Maisha says some of those new restrictions are just a reflection of those fears. But she says the people who live here are tight-knit. They're rural oddballs in a concrete jungle.
The soil is our common denominator. And so there wasn't a big stretch to become neighbors or to become community because we were a community based on soil and animals. And so we all know each other. We all speak to each other. We know each other's animals. If somebody's animal gets loose, a horse or cow, we know whose it is, just like we know their children.
This is Compton. No Dre, no Cube, no guns, no gangsters. It doesn't fit the story we all know. But if you're ever passing through the city, keep your ears open. You might just hear the roosters. The writer David Foster Wallace struggled with depression for most of his adult life. In 2008, at the age of 46, he took his own life. One of his final acts was to tidy up the manuscript of a novel he'd been working on at the time. The book was supposed to be the follow-up to his 1996 masterwork, Infinite Jest. He'd been working on the book at the time for about 10 years. He called it The Pale King, and later this month, that book will finally be published, but it is not complete. David Foster Wallace never finished it, so his editor at Little Brown, Michael Peach, had to piece it together from the thousands of pages and notes that David Foster Wallace left behind. And Michael Peach joins me now to talk about that process from New York. Welcome.
Thanks, Guy.
Also with us is Wallace's longtime agent, Bonnie Nadel. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
First to you, Michael. By way of explaining briefly what the book is about, I will say that it comes out on April 15th, officially in the bookstores. Can you explain why, Michael?
We chose to publish on April 15th as a way of casting a comic light on a novel that has a lot of darkness surrounding it. And that comic light is that the book is set at the IRS Tax Return Processing Center based in Peoria, Illinois. It centers on the lives and work of a group of IRS tax return processors.
We're going to obviously return to some of the themes in the book later, but first I want to ask you, Bonnie, David Foster Wallace called this book, and I'm quoting here, "The Long Thing." He compared writing it to trying to carry a sheet of plywood in a windstorm. Do you think that the struggle, his struggle in writing this book, contributed to his death?
It partly did. I mean, there were a lot of things that contributed to his suicide. Part of it had to do with fighting depression. Hmm. Part of it comes from going off his medication. But it was a hard book for him to finish, and he never did finish it.
He had been, Bonnie, he had been married in 2004. By some accounts, he was in a kind of a happy, at least personally, he was in a happy place in his life, decided he was going to go off one of the antidepressants that he'd been taking for many years. But what? I mean, what happened?
Well, he was in a really happy place. I mean, I knew David for 25 years, and I had never seen him as happy and as mature in his life. I mean, he was teaching at Pomona College, which he really enjoyed. Mm. He liked living in California. He and Karen had bought a house.
Karen was his wife, of course, Karen Green.
He was very settled. Part of the reason why he decided to go off the antidepressant he was on was because he was happy and settled and felt if there was a time to do it, it was now. Unfortunately, the best intentions that he had didn't work out that way.
Michael Peach, you are usually used to sort of being in the background, one of the quiet geniuses who makes great writers even better. You did that with David Foster Wallace. First of all, can you describe what he left behind?
What David left behind was nearly 3,000 pages of drafts in various forms. Some of them were handwritten. Some of them were neatly typed. Some of them were on computer disks. They were tucked away in various folders. They were spread all through his office. It was this massive material.
Just a pile of things. And in no particular order, just like puzzle pieces.
It was a puzzle piece. Within the book, there were repeated references to tornadoes, and in notes he'd written to himself, to a tornadic structure that suggested that he wanted this book to be kind of a whirling high wind, massive material coming at the reader that way. So those were some of the guidelines that I followed.
Besides that manuscript, David Foster Wallace left a typed note, and he laid out the premise of The Pale King, and this is what he writes. He says, "Bliss, a second-by-second joy and gratitude at the gift of being alive, conscious, lies on the other side of crushing, crushing boredom." Michael Peach, what was he getting at here?
The book attempts the greatest challenge I've ever seen a novelist take on, which is to write a novel about the boring parts of life. Every other novelist in history is compressed about around the exciting part.
Right.
Elmore Leonard famously said he became successful when he learned to leave out the parts that people skip. David's goal from the very start was to make people look at the parts they usually skip. There's a chapter written by a character named David Foster Wallace, and he begins by saying, "Go back and read that fine print on the copyright page of the book." His goal was to make people look at the parts of life that they don't usually focus on, and understand that this is where life is really happening.
I mean, he has scenes where he's talking about characters auditing tax returns.
He has characters auditing tax returns. He has characters having long conversations when stuck in an elevator that stopped between floors. He very amusingly sets scenes in these sort of agonizing circumstances, but he makes them riveting. He makes them brilliant. He makes them glorious, and he shows to get outside of ourselves and to actually connect with another person, you have to navigate all the complexity of life, all the difficult, complicated details. By doing that, then you can get to joy and to love and to the meaning of life. So the book deals with boredom, but it's because it wants to deal with joy.
Bonnie Nadel, David Foster Wallace researched this book by taking accounting classes. Can you describe what else went into his preparation?
Well, David was, as well as being an amazing writer, was quite a prodigy at math. And so he could take very advanced accounting classes and follow them. He also started correspondences with various accountants around the country, his own accountant, who did his taxes and his wife's taxes, loved him to pieces because no one ever asks about all the minutia of doing someone's taxes. And there is a whole section in The Pale King where he has characters talking about the tax code and how the tax code has changed and why it's changed. You remember that part, Michael.
Of course. Also, just to respond further to your question, Guy.
Sure.
The main theme of the book is the complexity and tedium of work. David had written essays about how he wanted to write fiction that really connected with people's true lives. And in this novel, I see him grappling with that. Mm. He's trying to write about what it's like to go home to the same spouse every day for 40, 50 years. How do you look into the face of a job that you know you're going to go and do again for 40 years? How do you do the things that you need to do again and again? How can you find meaning? How can you find delight? How do you find love? How do you find someone who will sit with you while you talk about what happened to you in line waiting to get to the bank teller? David was using this book as a way of trying to write about people and then try to arrive at meaning that connected to people in a really big, deep, heartfelt way.
There are parts of this book that are, I think it's fair to say, a bit of a slog, even boring. And I'm wondering if that was deliberate.
I think that's a question that is going to be wildly debated for good reason. Are those chapters that might be called boring, boring because he didn't finish them? My argument is yes. There are chapters that he did not revise as tightly and as forcefully as he revised some. I imagine this novel, if David had continued working on it, would not have been boring for a second, but I'm prejudiced.
Bonnie or Michael, as both of you talk about this book in the coming weeks and months, I imagine you're going to get this question. Do you think that he would have wanted us to read this, all of us, even unfinished?
Bonnie, what do you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think he did. He left it in his office for people to find. Our only hesitation was to know if we thought it was good enough and publishable enough, and that's why it actually took us a number of months before any of us made that decision.
Michael?
It is a fair question, and I think it's human nature to ask that question when confronted with a posthumous work. Bonnie has spoken to her surmise about David's intent, the fact that he left pages on his desk when he died. And he's someone who threw out things constantly, throughout every piece of correspondence he ever received, practically. So he was clearly capable of throwing out things he didn't want to have. So, and as I read these pages, I had no doubt at all. This novel contains writing and thought as great and as deep as anything David ever did. It's heartbreaking that it's not finished, but it's absolutely exhilarating for those of us who loved his work. And how can we not show that to the world?
That's Michael Peach. He was David Foster Wallace's editor at Little Brown, and the person who pieced together manuscripts to help create Wallace's forthcoming posthumous novel, The Pale King. We also heard from Bonnie Nadell. She was David Foster Wallace's literary agent. Bonnie, Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. This is a voice in great demand right now. The finest opera houses around the world clamor to have this voice resounding through their halls. It belongs to Vittorio Grigolo.
Risponder dovrei, tutti mentite.
This is from Vittorio Grigolo's first solo album of operatic music. It's titled, simply enough, The Italian Tenor. Guy sat down with him recently when they were both in Los Angeles.
Vittorio, you should know, is something of a sex symbol in the world of opera. He came into the studio wearing designer sunglasses, a white shirt buttoned just past his belly button, along with a shade of stubble on his face. But aside from his good looks, he's also considered a great new hope in the world of opera, the next Pavarotti. And like his hero Pavarotti, Grigolo loves performing work by Italian composers. So on the new record, he deliberately chose pieces only from Italian operas.
I'm dealing with composers that come from my country, like Verdi, Puccini, and Donizetti. For me, it's like I wanted really, you said this is my first album, classical, of course. It's something that it was in my dream since I was a little kid, since I was in my room performing like crazy, all the arias of everybody. It's something that I felt my body and my voice is ready now to deliver.
Right.
And now that as a painter, I had the opportunity to color this beautiful landscape and have all the color to make all those little shades.
What does an Italian singer bring to these compositions that other singers might not obviously? I mean, obviously you have the language, but is there a feeling, a sensibility that you bring to that because you are Italian?
I think it's the way I feel the pause in between music. I know the time I need in between a word to another to make it effective. If I say, for example, you're a very, very funny guy, you're a very funny guy. Or if I say, you know what, you're a very funny guy. It means, you know, it's in music as in acting.
Yeah.
The most beautiful things is the pause in between.
Right.
Calma trama infernale, la gloria mia avvolse in un istante, ed ogni speme troncò.
My guest is the opera singer Vittorio Grigolo, and his latest album is called The Italian Tenor. You'll be performing in Italy again in June. You'll be in Milan for Romeo and Juliet at La Scala, the most storied, famous opera house in the world, a place that opened when America was still fighting its revolution. You first performed there when you were 23. Describe what it is like.
I was very excited, President was there, president of Italy there, press, flowers all over, this stage big, huge, you know, this little piano, you know, the excited adrenaline, the sweat, you can hear the people, you know, checking time, 3, 2, 1, like, so, and the guy, you know, said, okay, you have your music? I checked my music, I had the wrong score. Oh my God, I said, Max, it's not possible, I have to take my other score, I can't do this. No, it's not possible, no time. Look at the score of the other people. I actually had the girl next to me, okay? She has a big cleavage, you know? Uh-huh. And I had to look at the score of her. But from the TV, it looks like I was looking on the boobs, you know, on the chest, on the breast of the lady. And my mom said all the time, I said, what's going on? I said, he's not even singing. He's looking at the breast of the girl from the TV. And everybody said, and then when I went home, I said, Mom, I was not looking at the breast. I was looking at the notes because I forgot my score. But nobody knows, of course. So it was a very strange story and a very funny story about my debut in La Scala.
I want to hear another performance from the record. This is from the first act of Puccini's La Bohème. Here you are performing as a Rodolfo. Just about all of the arias on this record cast you in the romantic lead. And there's another part of you that is a big part of who you are. I mean, you are, and this is radio, so I should describe you.
Yeah.
You are a very handsome guy. You are a big sex symbol. and yet you're
I'm
also
blushing.
Does that make you feel uncomfortable, or do you just kind of have to embrace that and you know?
You want to embrace it? It's okay. You know what? If I need to perform Romeo and Juliet, you need to have a good body. You don't want to see a big bulge jumping around like Nureyev and pretending to be Romeo, you know? Of course, people want today, that requires not only a beautiful voice, but it requires acting, it requires trained bodies. That's why sometimes careers also last a little bit less and they got shorter.
Rolando Villazón, who's another young tenor, he had to have surgery to remove a cyst from his vocal cords a few years ago. Some say that he overworked his voice. How do you deal with the demands of your job, of what you do?
First of all, it's important to have a teacher that stays always with you. I had the same teacher since I'm 17, and maybe this was the key, you know. Of course, 3 years ago start really my, how you say, my jump, my race, you know? Yes. So I had to learn quickly a lot of roles, and that was the moment I could have put my voice in danger, because the request, the people want to talk, the TV, the album, everything is so so tight. I think a voice is like a good wine. If you work it well, it will mature.
That's the opera singer Vittorio Grigolo. His latest album is called The Italian Tenor. Vittorio, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to this edition of Weekends and All Things Considered. The program this week was directed by Petra Mayer, produced by Phil Harrell, Lauren Silverman, Brent Bachman, Lily Percy, and Jessica Deal. Daniel Shukin is our technical director. Our intern is Megan Kane. Mathoni Maturi was our editor. Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next Sunday with the best of Weekends on All Things Considered. And remember, you can hear the entire program, the show in its entirety, every Saturday and Sunday on your local public radio station. It usually airs around 5 p.m. in most places.